Leaving the Village. I am your host, Kathleen Reynolds.
And I am your host, Jessica Goforth.
And today we are diving into chapter 24 of The Handmaid's Tale. Last time we did 22 and 23, which was a little less than we usually do, but it was kind of jam-packed. And if you will forgive us, Jess is dealing with cedar pollen season in Texas.
Yes.
And I am dealing with just general frog in your throat season in Cincinnati. And so I think we'll be okay. But if you hear a little bit of oddness from either one of us, that's what that is. Mm-hmm. So to remind everybody where we left off last time, June had just gone back to her room after her scandalous game of Scrabble with the commander, and he had asked her to kiss him at the very end. And she had just given him a very perfunctory closed mouth kiss. And he was kind of like, he very sadly said, "Not like that. Like, you mean it."
Mm-hmm.
And then June said, because it was that the whole theme of the chapter had been, this is a reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, this also is a reconstruction. So now we're starting chapter 24, which is section 9. And it starts with night.
Mm-hmm.
So
she's back in her room. She's kind of taking stock of everything. And, you know, she kind of goes over herself and, you know, I'm 33 years old. I have brown hair. I stand 5'7" without shoes. I have trouble remembering what I used to look like. I have viable ovaries. I have one more chance. And so she's kind of taking stock. And then she realizes that, you know, she has this memory of Aunt Lydia talking about manipulating men, basically. And she realizes that she has this opportunity, right? This chance that's been offered to her. And she says, but how to fit the commander into this? As he exists in his study with his word games and his desire for what? To be played with? To be gently kissed, as if I meant it. I know I need to take it seriously, this desire of his. It could be important. It could be a passport. It could be my downfall. I need to be earnest about it. I need to ponder it. But no matter what I do, sitting here in the dark with the searchlights illuminating the oblong of my window from outside through the curtains, gauzy as a bridal dress, as ectoplasma, plasm? I don't know what that is. As ectoplasm.
It's the supposed, like, substance that ghosts leave behind.
One of my hands holding the other, rocking back and forth a little. No matter what I do, there's something hilarious about it. He wanted me to play Scrabble with him and kiss him as if I meant it. This is one of the most bizarre things that's happened to me ever. Context is all.
Yeah, and then she says, I remember a television program I saw once, a rerun, made years before. I must have been 7 or 8, 2 years, or too young to understand it. It was the sort of thing my mother liked to watch, historical, educational. She tried to explain it to me afterwards to tell me that the things in it had really happened, but to me it was only a story. I thought that someone had made it up. I suppose all children think that about any history before their own. It's only a story. If it's only a story, it becomes less frightening. Mm. The program was a documentary about one of those wars. And what she's talking about is a very common kind of story that happened after World War II. And I believe she's actually talking about a specific interview. The interviewed people and showed clips from films of the time, black and white and still photos. I don't remember much about it, but I remember the quality of the pictures, the way everything in them seemed to be coated with a mixture of sunlight and dust, and how dark the shadows were under the people's eyebrows and along their cheekbones. The interviews with people still alive then were in color. Which, they don't show them as much anymore because we're much more removed from World War II than we were, say, when Jess and I were kids. Mm-hmm. But they used to show them a lot more. And if you ever have a chance to go and look at some interviews with some World War II survivors, especially ones that were done, like, say, in the 80s, it's a very interesting, stark contrast between the video footage and the photos from the 40s and the video footage from the 80s. And because this is when Margaret Atwood is writing, that's what she's basically talking about, the new stuff from the 80s that's in color. The one I remember best was with a woman who had been the mistress of a man who had been supervised, who had supervised one of the camps where they put the Jews before they killed them. In ovens, my mother said. But there weren't any pictures of the ovens, so I got some confused notion that these deaths had taken place in kitchens. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. This is probably largely autobiographical, actually.
Yeah.
Right here. There is something especially terrifying to a child in that idea. Ovens mean cooking, and cooking comes before eating. I thought these people had been eaten, which, in a way, I suppose they had been. From what they said, the man had been cruel and brutal. The mistress, my mother explained to mistress, she did not believe in mystification. I had a pop-up book of sexual organs by the time I was 4. That's equal parts hysterical and horrifying.
I don't want pop-up books of sexual organs.
The mistress had once been very beautiful. There was a black and white shot of her and another woman in the two-piece bathing suits and platform shoes and picture hats of the time. They were wearing cat's eye sunglasses and sitting in deck chairs by a swimming pool. The swimming pool was beside their house, which was near the camp with the ovens. The woman said she didn't notice much that she found unusual. She denied knowing about the ovens. This is an example of, I doubt that she was lying. I think she was probably rewriting the narrative in her head.
Yeah.
At the time of the interview, 40 or 50 years later, she was dying of emphysema. She coughed a lot, and she was very thin, almost emaciated, but she still took pride in her appearance. Look at that, said my mother, half grudgingly, half admiringly. She still takes pride in her appearance. She was carefully made up, heavy mascara on her eyelashes, rouge on the bones of her cheeks, over which the skin was stretched like a rubber glove pulled tight. She was wearing pearls. He was not a monster, she said. People said he was a monster, but he was not one. What could she have been thinking about? Not much, I guess. Not back then, not at the time. She was thinking about how not to think. She was thinking about how not to think.
Mm-hmm.
Times were abnormal. She took pride in her appearance. She did not believe he was a monster. he was not a monster to her. Probably he had some endearing trait. He whistled off-key in the shower. He had a yen for truffles. He called his dog Lichben and made it sit up for little pieces of raw steak. Or Liebkin, sorry, which I believe means little love or something like that. Mm. How easy it is to invent a humanity for anyone at all. What an available temptation. Mm. A big child, she would have said to herself. Her heart would have melted. She'd have smoothed her hair back from his forehead, kissed him on the ear, and not just to get something out of him either, the instinct to soothe, to make it better. "There, there," she'd say, as he woke from a nightmare. "Things are so hard for you." All this she would have believed, because otherwise how could she have kept on living? She was very ordinary under the beauty. She believed in decency. She was nice to the Jewish maid, or nice enough, nicer than she needed to be. Several days after this interview with her was filmed, she killed herself. It said that right on television. Nobody asked her whether or not she had loved him. What I remember now most of all is the makeup. And this, this is such a prime example of, you know, she is making herself believe with the makeup, with her narrative, with everything. She is, with everything she has in her, making herself believe that everything is good and everything's fine and she's not doing anything bad and those around her are not doing anything bad. But somehow, somewhere deep inside of her, when the truth is as awful as the Holocaust,
mm-hmm.
you can't gaslight yourself that much.
Yeah.
And she wound up killing herself because, and whether this one was a specific real life one or not, it is very reminiscent of many real such people.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, which segues incredibly into her next section where she talks about, I stand up in the dark and start to unbutton. Then I hear something inside my body. I've broken. Something has cracked. That must be it. Noise is coming up, coming out of the broken place in my face. Without warning, I wasn't thinking about here or there or anything. If I let the noise get out into the air, it will be laughter. Too loud. Too much of it. Someone is bound to hear, and then there will be hurrying footsteps and commands, and who knows? Judgment. Emotion inappropriate to the occasion. The wandering womb. They think hysteria. And then a needle, a pill. It could be fatal. I cram both hands over my mouth as if I'm about to be sick. Drop to my knees. The laughter boiling like lava in my throat. I crawl into the cupboard, draw up my knees. I'll choke on it. My ribs hurt from holding back. I shake. I heave. Seismic. Volcanic. I'll burst. Red all over the cupboard. Mirth rhythms like birth. Oh, to die of laughter. I stifle it in the folds of the hanging cloak. Clench my eyes from which tears are squeezing. Try to compose myself. After a while it passes, like an epileptic fit. Here I am in the closet. Nolite te bastardus carborundorum. I can't see it in the dark, but I trace the tiny scratched writing with the ends of my fingers, as if it's a code in Braille. It sounds in my head now like a prayer. More like a command, but to do what? Useless to me in any case. An ancient hieroglyphic to which the key's been lost. Why did she write it? Why did she bother? There's no way out of here. I'll stop there.
Oh. Yeah.
It's a lot. She's just been through a lot. Mm-hmm. Like a lot. The birth and then being summoned and then all the emotions of reading, of playing with words when words are forbidden.
Yeah.
And then the kiss at the end and all of the, just all of it. It's a lot. Mm-hmm. No wonder she broke.
Yeah. And then we get into chapter 25, and a couple pages in, she says, one day I came upon Serena Joy, kneeling on a cushion in the garden. Her cane was beside her on the grass. She was snipping off the seed pods with a pair of shears. I watched her sideways as I went past with my basket of oranges and lamb chops. She was aiming, positioning the blades of the shears, then cutting with a compulsive jerk of the hands. Was it the arthritis creeping up? Or some blitzkrieg, some kamikaze committed on the swelling genitalia of the flowers? The fruiting body. To cut off the seed pods is supposed to make the bulb store energy. Saint Serena on her knees doing penance. I often amused myself this way with small, mean-minded, bitter jokes about her, but not for long. It doesn't do to linger watching Serena Joy from behind. What I coveted was the shears.
Mm-hmm.
And then the commander and I have an arrangement. It's not the first such arrangement in history, though the shape it's taken is not the usual one. I visit the commander 2 or 3 nights a week, always after dinner, but only when I get the signal. The signal is Nick. If he's polishing the car when I set out for the shopping, or when I come back, and if his hat is on askew or not at all, then I go. If he isn't there, or if he has his hat on straight, then I stay in my room in the ordinary way. On ceremony nights, of course, none of this applies. The difficulty is the wife, as always. After dinner, she goes to their bedroom, from where she could conceivably hear me as I sneak along the hall, although I take care to be very quiet, or she stays in the sitting room knitting away at her endless angel scarves, turning out more and more yards of intricate and useless wool people for her form of procreation, it must be. That's a nice little jab at her.
Mm-hmm.
The sitting room door is usually left ajar when she's in there, and I don't dare go past it. When I've had the signal but can't make it down the stairs or along the hall past the sitting room, the commander understands. He knows my situation none better. He knows all the rules. Sometimes, however, Serena Joy is out visiting another commander's wife, a sick one. That's the only place she could conceivably go by herself in the evenings. She takes food, a cake or pie or loaf of bread baked by Rita, or a jar of jelly made from the mint leaves that grow in her garden. They get sick a lot, these wives of commanders. It adds interest to their lives. As for us, the handmaids and even the Marthas, we avoid illness. The Marthas don't want to be forced to retire because who knows where they go. You don't see very many old women around anymore. And for us, any real illness, anything lingering, weakening, a loss of flesh or appetite, a fall of hair, a failure of the glands would be terminal. I remember Cora earlier in the spring staggering around, even though she had the flu, holding onto the door frames when she thought no one was looking, being careful not to cough. A slight cold, she said when Serena asked her. Serena herself sometimes takes a few days off, tucked up in bed. Then she's the one to get the company, the wives rustling up the stairs, clucking and cheerful. She gets the cakes and pies, the jelly, the bouquets of flowers from their gardens. They take turns. There's some sort of list, invisible, unspoken. Each is careful not to hog more than her share of the attention. On the nights when Serena is due to be out, I'm sure to be summoned. The first time I was confused, his needs were obscure to me, and what I could perceive of them seemed to me ridiculous, laughable, like a fetish for lace-up shoes. And then there have, and or also there have been letdowns of sorts. What had I been expecting behind that closed door the first time? Something unspeakable, down on all fours, perhaps? Perversions, whips, mutilations, at the very least some minor sexual manipulation, some bygone peccadillo now denied him, prohibited by law and punishable by amputation. To be asked to play Scrabble instead, as if we were an old married couple or two children, seemed kinky in the extreme. A violation, in its own way. As a request, it was opaque. So when I left the room, it still wasn't clear to me what he wanted or why, or whether I could fulfill any of it for him. If there's to be a bargain, the terms of exchange must be set forth. This was something he certainly had not done. I thought he might be toying some cat and mouse routine, but now I think that his motives and desires weren't obvious even to him. They had not yet reached the level of words. The second evening began in the same way as the first. I went to the door, which was closed, knocked on it, and was told to come in. Then followed the same two games with the smooth beige counters, prolix, quartz, quandary, sylph, rhythm. All the old tricks with consonants I could dream up or remember. My tongue felt thick with the effort of spelling. It was like using a language I'd once known had forgotten. A language having to do with customs that had long before passed out of the world. Cafe au lait at an outdoor table with brioche, absinthe in a tall glass, or shrimp in a cornucopia of newspaper. Things I'd read about once but had never seen. It was like trying to walk without crutches, like those phony scenes in old TV movies. You can do it. I know you can. That was the way my mind lurched and stumbled among the sharp R's and T's, sliding over the ovoid vowels as if on pebbles. The commander was patient when I hesitated or asked him for a correct spelling. We can always look it up in the dictionary, he said. He said we. The first time I realized he'd let me win. Remember, she had said that she had let him win the second time.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And she was actually realizing that it was the other way around because she was so rusty in spelling.
Mm-hmm.
That night, I was expecting everything to be the same, including the goodnight kiss, but when we'd finished the second game, he sat back in his chair. He placed his elbows on the arms of the chair, the tips of his fingers together, and he looked at me. I have a little present for you, he said. He smiled a little. He pulled out the open top drawer of his desk and took something out. He held it a moment, casually enough, between thumb and finger, as if deciding whether or not to give it to me. Although it was upside down from where I was sitting, I recognized it. They were once common enough. It was a magazine, a woman's magazine. It looked like, from the picture, a model on the glossy paper, hair blown, neck scarfed, mouth lipsticked. The fall fashions. I thought such magazines had all been destroyed, but here was one left over in a commander's private study, where you'd least expect to find such a thing. He looked down at the model, who was right side up to him. He was still smiling, that wistful smile of his. It was a look that you'd give to an almost extinct animal at the zoo. Staring at the magazine as he dangled it before me like fish bait, I watched it. I wanted it with a force that made the ends of my fingers ache. At the same time, I saw this longing of mine as trivial and absurd because I'd taken such magazines lightly enough once. I'd read them in dentist's offices and sometimes on planes. I'd brought them to take to hotel rooms, a device to fill in empty time while I was waiting for Luke. After I'd leafed through them, I would throw them away, for they were infinitely discardable. And a day or two later, I wouldn't be able to remember what had been in them. Though I remembered now, what was in them was promise. They dealt with transformations. They suggested an endless series of possibilities, extending like the reflections in two mirrors that sit facing one another, searching on replica after replica to the vanishing point.
Mm-hmm.
They suggested one adventure after another, one wardrobe after another, one improvement after another, one man after another. They suggested rejuvenation, pain overcome and transcended, endless love. The real promise in them was immortality. This is what he was holding without knowing it. He rifled the pages. I felt myself leaning forward. "It's an old one," he said, "a curio of sorts, from the 70s, I think, a Vogue." "This, like a wine connoisseur dropping a name, I thought you might like to look at it." Mm. And then they go back and forth, and she thinks he might be, like, testing her or teasing her. And then she finally takes it and starts looking through and, like, sees images that she remembers from childhood, and he's watching her.
Mm-hmm.
And she says she knows that she's doing something that she shouldn't have been doing, and that he found pleasure. So he's essentially getting off and watching her do something that she's not supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then she says, "By Aunt Lydia's lights, I was evil, but I didn't feel evil. Instead, I felt like an old Edwardian seaside postcard. Naughty." What was he going to give me next? A girdle? "Why do you have this?" I asked him. "Some of us," he said, "retain an appreciation for the old things." "But these were supposed to have burned," I said. "There were house-to-house searches, bonfires." "What's dangerous in the hands of the multitudes," he said, with what may or may not have been irony, "is safe enough for those whose motives are beyond reproach," I said. He nodded gravely. "Impossible to tell whether or not he meant it." "But why show it to me?" I said, and then felt stupid. What could he possibly say? That he was amusing himself at my expense? "For he must have known how painful it was to me to be reminded of the former time. I wasn't prepared for what he actually did say. Who else could I show it to?" he said. And there it was again, that sadness.
Mm-hmm.
So here we have, in some ways, like, he is, yes, he is seducing her. He is entering into a relationship with her that he should not have. He is doing all sorts of things here that he shouldn't be doing. But part of it is not, I mean, a lot of it is power, don't get me wrong, but part of it is not. Part of it is sheer, stark loneliness in this world that has been created. Who else can I show it to?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. There's no one else.
Yeah. It's a type of emotional affair, really, for him on his side.
Right. A lot of it is. And it's one that, you know, a place like Gilead is set up in such a way that in order to thrive, you almost have to have some sort of illicit emotional affair.
Yeah.
That's the way it's set up.
Yeah, because so many emotions are illegal.
Right. And you have to find, we talked last time about how allyships exist everywhere and of one type or another. And I mentioned the true ally. And you have to find either your true ally or the ally that you can have some sort of quid pro quo. And
yeah.
That's, or some sort of bribing, but not enough bribing that it negates the effects of the allyship. Because if this particular allyship were 1,000% about power, then it wouldn't do anything for him. he has to know that she's getting something from it too, which she is.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a, he is not an inherently power hungry person.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, he doesn't want an allyship that is based solely on what do I hold over you. So how can I make my puppet dance? There's a little bit of that, but he wouldn't, again, he's not a narcissist. He's not a completely power hungry person, and therefore he has to know that the person that he's in this allyship is getting something too, one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's conscious or not. And you can see that in the way he is working with her, grooming her, but yeah, also building a genuine relationship with her.
Yeah.
It's this very odd juxtaposition of predatory and genuinely, like, he genuinely needs a friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's so interesting, this whole, speaking of the power imbalance in this friendship, you know, he finally gives her this lotion. She asks for hand lotion, mm-hmm, basically, and he gives it to her. And she says, the trouble is, I said, I don't have anywhere to keep it. In your room, he said, as if this were obvious. They'd find it, I said. Someone would find it. Why? He asked, as if he really didn't know. Maybe he didn't. It wasn't the first time he gave evidence of being truly ignorant of the real conditions under which we lived. They look, I said, they look in all our rooms. For what? He said. I think I lost control then, a little. Razor blades, I said. Books, writing, black market stuff, all the things we weren't supposed to have. Jesus Christ, you ought to know. My voice was angrier than I'd intended, but he didn't even wince. Then you'll have to keep it here, he said. So that's what I did. And so it's just such an odd imbalance of power that makes this, you know, so complicated, so
mm-hmm,
even less safe for her, you know, like, he is fine, but she is the one taking all these risks. He'll be fine, but she won't.
Yep.
And that is the nature of extreme power differentials. And it's one of the things that, you know, to bring this back to ATI stuff, it's like when Gilead, when the people in the story designed Gilead, they designed it with a specific ideal in mind. They wanted a utopia of sorts that fit their idea of what was good and right. In the process, they lost so much that they didn't anticipate losing. And so now they're all sitting here in this, you know, they won. They got what they wanted, and yet they lost so much. And I think that that's, you know, what happened with ATI in a lot of ways. They created this utopian family life where you have this extreme hierarchy and these umbrellas of protection. But then it becomes incredibly lonely. Everyone is isolated from everyone else. There is no way to connect in a way that is equal. And so therefore, mm-hmm, the idea that this was going to be this wonderful utopia of marriage and family life for these students that were being raised in ATI, that was their future, it all fell apart because we all ended up in these stupid power differentials in our marriages, in our homes. And it destroyed any sense of connection and healthy intimacy. Pretty sad.
It is. It is. And then chapter 26. It is time for the ceremony again. And she says, I found that things were changed. There was an awkwardness now that there hadn't been before. Before, I had treated it as a job, an unpleasant job to be gone through as fast as possible so that it could be over with. But that night, the first since the beginning of whatever this new arrangement was between us, I had no name for it. I felt shy of him. I felt, for one thing, that he was actually looking at me, and I didn't like it. The lights were on, as usual, since Serena Joy always avoided anything that would have created an aura of romance or eroticism, however slight. Overhead lights, harsh despite the canopy. It was like being on an operating table in the full glare, like being on stage. I was conscious that my legs were hairy, in the straggly way of legs that have once been shaved but have grown back. I was conscious of my armpits, too, although, of course, he couldn't see them. I felt uncouth. This act of copulation, fertilization, perhaps, which should have been no more to me than a bee is to a flower, had become for me indecorous, an embarrassing breach of propriety, which it hadn't been before. He was no longer a thing to me. That was the problem, I realized. I realized it that night, and the realization has stayed with me. It complicates. Serena Joy had changed for me, too. Once I'd merely hated her for the part in what was being done for me, and because she hated me, too, and resented my presence, and because she would be the one to raise my child should I be able to have one after all. But now, although I still hated her no more so than when she was gripping my hand so hard her rings bit my flesh, pulling my hands back as well, which she must have done on purpose to make me as uncomfortable as she could, the hatred was no longer pure and simple. Partly, I was jealous of her. But how could I be jealous of a woman so obviously dried up and unhappy? You can only be jealous of someone who has something you think you ought to have. Nevertheless, I was jealous, but I also felt guilty about her. I was an intruder in a territory that ought to have been hers. Now that I was seeing the commander on the sly, if only to play games and listen to him talk, our functions were no longer as separate as they should have been in theory. I was taking something away from her, although she didn't know it. I was filching. Never mind that it was something she apparently didn't want or had no use for, had rejected even, still it was hers. And if I took it away, this mysterious it I couldn't quite define for the commander wasn't in love with me. I refused to believe he felt anything for me as extreme for that. What would be left for her? Why should I care? I told myself. She's nothing to me. She dislikes me. She'd have me out of the house in a minute or worse if she could think of any excuse at all. If she were to find out, for instance, he wouldn't be able to intervene to save me. Also, I now had power over her, of a kind, although she didn't know it, and I enjoyed that. Why pretend? I enjoyed it a lot. But the commander could give me away so easily by a look, by a gesture, some tiny slit that would reveal to anyone watching that there was something between us now. He almost did it the night of the ceremony. He reached his hand up as if to touch my face. I moved my head to the side to warn him away, hoping Serena Joy hadn't noticed. Don't do that again, I said to him the next time we were alone. Do what, he said, try to touch me like that when she's there. Did I, he said. You could get me transferred, I said, to the colonies. You know that, or worse. I'm sorry, he said, I didn't mean to, but I find it. What, I said. Impersonal, he said. How long did it take you to figure that out? I said. You can see from the way I was speaking to him that we were already on different terms. The fact is that I'm his mistress. Men at the top have always had mistresses. Why should things be any different now? The arrangements aren't quite the same, granted. The mistress used to be kept in a minor house or apartment of her own. Now they've amalgamated things. But underneath, it's the same, more or less. outside woman, they used to be called in some countries. I am the outside woman. It's my job to prove what is otherwise lacking, or to provide what is otherwise lacking. Even the Scrabble, it's as absurd as well as an ignominious position. Mm-hmm. I'm happier than I was before. It's something to do, for one thing. Something to fill the time at night instead of sitting alone in my room. It's something else to think about. I don't love the commander or anything like it, but he's of interest to me. He occupies space. He is more than a shadow. And I for him. To him, I'm no longer merely a usable body. To him, I'm not just a boat with no cargo, a chalice with no wine in it, an oven, to be crude, minus the bun. To him, I am not merely empty. And wow. This shows, again, this goes back to what she was talking about with alliances. And They have formed a sort of alliance. And it's been mostly on the commander's terms. And the beginning of the alliance ship or allyship has been on the commander's terms. But she's been able to make tiny little moves to make some terms that suit her as well. So it's not altogether the worst thing that's ever happened to her.
Yeah.
Which shows you how bad this kind of situation is.
Oh, yeah, it's unthinkable.
And That's how things work in cults, where things that you would never consider before become something that you might consider, and something that makes life more bearable.
Mm-hmm. This is how trauma bonds are formed as well.
Yep.
Because things are so, so bad, and then there's this little kernel of peace or kindness or humor or whatever it is, and it creates this bond, this desire for it, and you'll endure pretty much anything to get back to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's rough. Yeah. So is this a good place to stop? We get into chapter 27 next time.
Yep.
And, we are more than halfway through the book.
Yeah, I think we've got about a third left.
Yep, and we're just cruising through. And, I think that's it.
I think it is. I think we've got, let's see. We're at 27, and I think we have about 20 chapters left.
Yeah.
So, depending on how many chapters we do per episode.
Yeah. We probably won't get done before Christmas.
No.
But we have really enjoyed this, and we're glad you've come along for it. And we'll pick up at chapter 27 next time. And That's it. Drop in our socials. Chat with us. Tell us what you're thinking about. What you're getting out of this stuff. We really enjoy hearing from you. And we will see you next time on Leaving the Village.
Bye.
Bye.
And that wraps up another episode of Leaving the Village.
If you haven't already, hit subscribe so you get our episodes as soon as they drop. Also, check out our social media pages at Leaving the Village Pod on Instagram as well as Facebook.
We will post behind-the-scenes photos, links to more information, and sneak peeks at upcoming guests. Message us with your stories and you might be featured on a future episode. Also, if you love the show, rate and comment on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps a lot.
Speaking of helping us, you can actually sponsor our show on Patreon, which also gets you access to exciting exclusive content. Our show is written and produced by me, Jessica Goforth, and Kathleen Reynolds. Special thanks to our families who are so supportive of this show, and to you, our fans. Thank you so much, and see you next time on Leaving the Village.